Okay, yeah, we're talking about Christian nationalism here. For most of you guys, I think everybody's been here. This is that idea that has been bubbling up in the last couple of years, but really kind of has happened to coincide somewhat with the political turmoil that we've been in, and some people have associated with the rise of Trumpism. Although it's, as we've looked at, been there before that, but probably has been accelerated. And I don't know if it's so much by a particular political candidate as much as it is by just a rise of progressivism around us, in the sense that the society is starting to come apart at the seams. And so that's caused a lot of people to reflect on what isn't working and what might work, and had caused a lot of people to just want to have conversations about how do we repair this. And that's all led back to ideas of Christian nationalism. You know, what does it mean to be a nation, and then within that nation as Christians, you know, what are we actually striving for? And a number of people have proposed that we need to strive to be a Christian nation, a self-consciously Christian nation, a Christian nation acting as a Christian nation. And so we've examined the merits of that, and to some extent whether or not that is even possible, and concluded that it's not possible apart from regeneration in the hearts of the people. And so to the extent that you believe the road is wide and the pathway is broad, that many people are finding it, you may believe in Christian nationalism. But to the extent that you think it's narrow and the gate is difficult to enter into, you're probably not going to have a whole lot of faith in the idea of Christian nationalism. We live in a pluralistic society, that our nation's been founded on that. In the past, that has generally meant tolerance of minority positions. Maybe even to begin with, it just meant tolerance of something other than a single state church. Eventually, it came to mean tolerance of even other religions, and that has really kind of dominated our nation from the beginning. It was predominantly an assumption that Christian ideals were the moral ideals of society. But recently, that pluralism has moved against the church. It's moved against us as Christians, and so we find ourselves less and less mainstream, less and less able to appeal to a common morality. And so pluralism itself has sort of become the formula that works against Christianity. And a lot of people therefore want to get rid of pluralism. They just want to eradicate that and get back to monism in some fashion, just where you have a single form of thought. And we've been arguing that that's really not, it's not going to happen, and it probably is not the thing that Christians need to be pushing for, at least not from a state-level control. What we really need to do is figure out a way to articulate the gospel in a compelling way so that it becomes, I don't want to say respectable, that's probably not the right word, but it becomes at least clearly understood what the clear advantages are of a Christian worldview. Now, I say all that and understand the spiritual dynamics that are in play whenever you articulate those kinds of things. You can't think about this just sociologically. You got to think about it biblically and spiritually as well. But at the same time, I think that there are some paradigms that demonstrate that even apart from a mass revival or a mass influx of people into the church, there is a time in history where the church seemed to be able to impact its society in a positive way, even apart from massive influx or even dominance in the cultural sphere in terms of number of Christians. And that's just the second century church. If you think about it, second century church is somewhat unique. It is obviously post-resurrection. It is Christian. So when you're thinking about the entirety of Revelation, whether it's the Old Testament or New Testament, you're normally thinking about something that's somewhat isolated within the land of Israel and issues that were alive within the state of Israel. Or in the New Testament, you know, you've got much of what we have in the New Testament takes place within Israel. Some of it obviously are Paul's letters to churches or the book of Acts and Paul's missionary journeys. But as that sort of season closed out, you had Christianity moving outside the boundaries of Israel, where its primary antagonist or its primary opponent was another monotheistic religion. In fact, it was if you want to say it this way, the mother religion of Christianity. It was Christianity extending the message of Judaism through its Messiah into its ultimate kingdom. You had that on one end. On another end, you would have eventually the statehood of Christianity through Constantine. You have a point where the empire adopts Christianity as its official religion. And on the in between those two components, you have this season, which is really the only season for the last 2,000 years where Western Christianity, Western civilization, has existed as a minority within the broader culture. And so it's helpful to think about that church and what they did, because the reality is they were incredibly successful by God's providence and God's grace, coming from a time when they were holding very little cultural influence. They were in many ways weak and frail. They were buffeted by internal factions and heresies. They were assaulted by pagan philosophers continually. They were fighting for their lives in a way like Christianity has not for a long, long time. This is a Christianity that itself was in a pluralistic society, maybe not democratically pluralistic like we are, but they were in a pluralistic society where they were having to answer questions such as, is there a God? Or how many gods are there? Or are all religions the same? And how can we know the difference? Those very same kind of questions that we're asking today, those weren't necessarily the questions that were asked in what people call Christendom, sort of that the state-sponsored Christianity or the Holy Roman Empire for centuries to come. But during this season, they were. They were being assaulted and having to defend all of these things. Now, it's important, I think, it's helpful to understand sort of the cultural, political sphere in which they were living. Because religion in the Roman Empire was looked at as something that was tied ethnically or nationally to particular places. And you still have that somewhat today, especially outside of the United States. When you go to Europe, people still associate their religion with their state to the point that, you know, to be Italian is to be Catholic, or to be Croatian is to be Catholic, or if you go into other places, to be, you know, to be German to some extent is still to be Lutheran. So you still have some of that. In America, that's not been as much of the case, but that was certainly true back in the days of the second century. And within that sort of identity, there was a kind of a stratification that took place because people associated ethnically and religiously in line with one another. And you pretty much were considered, or you were expected, to stay within those boundaries. So Jews were expected to stay Jewish. They were expected to be Jewish. They identified with the Jewish state and they identified with the Jewish religion. Romans had their particular gods, and they worshiped their gods, and they were, you know, they were content to do that. Greeks did the same thing, although there was obviously some overlap between their gods. They had their own particular pantheon of gods, and they were considered, you know, they were considered to be Greek gods. And to some extent, this is an extension of an ancient concept of favoritism by the gods. You know, people believe that their gods gave them not only fertility for the land, but victory in battle and all those other things. And so the idea of a god and the state were bound up together, to worship your particular gods was to support your particular state. All of these were the mentalities that were there when Christianity was introduced into the scene. And this was one of the grievances against Christianity, is that it didn't respect any of that stuff. It didn't respect the association of the religion with a particular ethnicity or a particular nationality or statehood, if you want to think about it that way. It was something that penetrated and in some ways detached people from these ethnic cultural components and acted independently of any of that. And so Christianity was looked at as a threat to the state, not as something that upheld the state. And this became the primary reason for its persecution. Or if you want to think about it another way, it was exclusive. It was exclusive in its claim of monotheism, for one thing. Apart from Judaism, it was the only ancient religion that claimed that there was only one God and that all the other gods were false gods. But then it was exclusive in the sense that you were called to renounce your previous gods in affinity for the true God. And people attacked that. One of the more famous attacks, or one of the more famous, I should say, records of this came from a Roman governor named Pliny, Pliny the Younger, as he is known, who wrote a letter around 111 AD to the Emperor Trajan. Pliny was in northern Turkey, acting as governor of that area, writing back to Rome, to Trajan. And he writes this: "For the matter seemed to me well worth referring to you, especially considering the numbers endangered." He's talking about the spread of Christianity here. "Persons of all ranks and ages and of both sexes are and will be involved in the prosecution. For this contagious superstition is not confined to the cities only, but has spread through the villages and the rural districts." So he's writing to give his complaint and get some advice from Trajan. And in his complaint, he's saying that the issue with this Christianity is it's spreading through all strata of society. It's going through all levels. It's going to all cities, all villages. It's penetrating in ways that other groups have not penetrated. And this is not viewed as a positive development by Pliny, and he wants to have some input back from Trajan in terms of what to do. His concern is not that at this point Christianity is illegal, because there was no law on the books that made it illegal. His concern is that this is, first of all, a superstition, which the word is in the original Greek is superstitio, which at that point meant something that was outside of the normal sink of tradition in society. That's really what it was. This is something that operated outside of traditional views. And this is one of the ways that Christianity was often referred to. Tacitus, 5 years later, wrote about Christianity and called it a pernicious superstition. Suetonius, writing 4 years after that, talking about the spread of Christianity, called it a mischievous superstition. This is the way they viewed Christianity. It was that. And part of it was the fact that it was non-traditional. Part of it was the fact that it was considered to be intellectually suspect and weak, and only appealing to weak-minded people and women was the accusation. They were concerned that Christianity was not only intellectually weak, but they were concerned that it was unattaching or detaching people from the state religion, which they believed created a cohesiveness in society. Religion was looked at as something that was supposed to bind people together. Cicero writes, in all probability, disappearance of piety towards the gods will entail the disappearance of loyalty and social union among the people. So religion, at least from the state leaders, was looked at as just a political tool, a cultural tool to bind all people together. And this is one of the sort of defenses of Christianity from some of the early Christians. In the epistle of Diognetus, the writer, we don't know if the writer was Diognetus or someone else, but the writer of that particular letter says to his detractors, "Christians are no different from other people in terms of their country, language, or customs. Nowhere do they inhabit their own cities, use a strange dialect, live life out of the ordinary, or otherwise disrupt the world." So this became one of the defenses of Christianity, is that we're not trying to undermine your society. We're not trying to undermine your state. We're not trying to undermine your cities or any of those other things. This was at the crux of the concern of Pliny and others. That Christianity was exclusive and a threat. And because of this, he complains that Christians don't participate in society. Another letter by a man named Minucius Felix, a pagan, writing about Christians, says this to the Christians: "You do not attend the shows, you take no part in the processions, you shy away from public banquets, you abhor the sacred games, meats from victims, drinks poured out in libation on the altars. So frightened are you of the very gods that you deny." So they were concerned that these people were refusing to be a part of society. They were refusing to worship the gods. They were refusing to participate in what was sort of the cultural milieu of the day. And this is why they were looked at as a threat. They were looked at as a threat because they weren't supposedly binding society together. They were pulling it apart by pulling people away from society. And they met not in the public temples, but in private homes. Or they met in the courtyards. They really didn't meet in the homes. They met in the courtyards of the homes. The homes themselves were far too small to have churches in them. If you've ever visited homes in Europe, you have a sense of the density of population in some of those cities. Well, it was even worse in the ancient world. If you ever go visit ruins of ancient cities and look at the size of some of the rooms, they're barely the size of our bedrooms. Architecture didn't allow for massive grand spaces in most cases, and so you couldn't really have churches inside of houses, but they would meet inside of courtyards. Many wealthy owners would have basically houses that surrounded a courtyard and had something of a portico or a porch on the front of those houses that all faced into the courtyard, and so people would go behind the closed walls, if you will, of some of these housing complexes, and they would meet there out in the open, but they were separated from the rest of society. They weren't in the open temples. And so this caused suspicion. And on top of that, people, they heard Christians referring to one another as brothers and sisters. They heard Christian husbands refer to their wives as their sisters, and Christian wives referred to their husbands as brothers. And this led to the accusation that Christians were incestuous people. They heard Christians talk about the Lord's table and assumed that they were talking about the literal eating of flesh, and so they were thought about as cannibals as well. So all these sort of what we would call today misinformation was floating around about Christians, and they were looked at as a secretive group that was pulling out of society and operating in their own sphere. And this caused Christians to have to do what we normally refer to as apologetic work. They had to answer all of these accusations. They had to answer the accusation that they were against the state. They had to answer the accusation that they were somehow just a dumb superstition. They had to answer the accusation that they were had these strange beliefs. And it led to what some people consider to be the golden age of apologetics. This was the time when Christians were forced to write in defense of their faith some of the best apologetic work that the church has ever written. And I think, as I said, given all of that sort of background and stuff, there's a lot that we can take from this, because as we mentioned, we're in a pluralistic society. We are, I think, in some ways resented because of our exclusive claims to Christ. There's the constant debate among Christians about the relative engagement that we ought to have with society. Oftentimes, the assumption is that the only way for us to win the cultural war, if you will, is to embrace all of the elements of the culture, to be at the parties and to be at the shows and to be even in the schools and, you know, in every way participating in society at the same level as everyone else. And so we have some of the same struggles today that the second century church had. And so it's interesting just to think about and to listen to some of the ways that they responded. And there are a number of these early Christian writers who basically wrote in defense of Christianity, not necessarily as at a philosophical level, but sometimes just as a better way of life. They just wrote and wrote and wrote about how Christians lived better lives in general because of their particular beliefs. Again, going back to this epistle of Diognetus, which dates from about 130 AD, he describes Christians. He says, Christians are distinguished from other men, as I said earlier, not by country, nor language, nor customs which they observe. They don't inhabit cities of their own, or employ peculiar forms of speech, or lead lives that are marked out by singularity. The course of conduct which they follow is not devised by any speculation or deliberation of inquisitive men, nor do they, like some, proclaim themselves advocates of merely human doctrines, but inhabiting Greek as well as barbarian cities, according to the lot of each of them, has determined, following the customs of the natives in respect to clothing and food and the rest of their ordinary conduct, they display to us their wonderful and confessingly striking method of life. They dwell in our countries as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others, and yet they endure all things as if foreigners. Every foreign land to them is their native country, and every land of their birth is like a land of strangers. They marry, as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live of the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but are citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws, and at the same time surpass the laws by their lives. So this is a generally considered a Christian document defending Christianity, and he's saying, yeah, these people are living, these Christians are living among you. They're citizens just like you. They're obeying your laws, but they're living above the laws. They're living better than the laws. They're going above and beyond what the laws are calling you to do. Their life is striking, he says. And among other things, they have a common table but not a common bed, meaning they're not sleeping around. They're living moral lives, but they're welcoming people to their table. They're sharing their food, not their beds. They're living in the they are in the flesh, but not living after the flesh. These, in other words, were commending. This was commending Christians for the kind of conduct that they had, but it was a conduct that was both separate and respectable. It was recognized that they were living as foreigners, but living in such a way that was very respectable. He goes on to say, to sum up all in one word, what the soul is in the body, that are Christians in the world. The soul is dispersed through all the members of the body. Christians are scattered through all the cities of the world. The soul dwells in the body, yet is not the body. Christians dwell in the world, but are not of the world. The invisible soul is guarded by the visible body. Christians are known indeed to be in the world, but their godliness remains invisible, meaning that it was a spiritual element. He says that the flesh hates the soul and wars against it, though itself suffers no injury because it's prevented from enjoying the pleasures. The world hates Christians, though in no wise injured because they abjure pleasures. So he's recognizing that the Christians were hated because they weren't participating as everyone else in the pleasures of the world. But they were recognizing them as being above, if you will, above those things. This is very similar to what Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 4 when he says that, therefore, since Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves in the same way of thinking, for whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time is past, and for the time past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they're surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you, but they will give account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is why the gospel is preached, even to those who are dead, that though judged in the flesh the way people are, they might live in the spirit the way God does. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be self-controlled, sober-minded for the sake of prayer. Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. And as he goes on to say, as you've received a gift, serve one another as stewards of God's grace. This is Peter's instruction. I don't know if you guys need this microphone to hear me. This is Peter's instruction in the mid-60s to what he recognized was already a rising animosity towards Christianity. His instruction to Christians to live in this world but not of it, to live these distinctive lives that were going to be marked out because of their virtue, even if they're maligned because of that very same virtue. So early Christians made their mark as people who were transformed by the power of God, surrendered to Him, and pursuing their heavenly citizenship. They weren't even trying to pursue a worldliness. They had no illusion that by being like the world, they were going to win the world. As I said, they felt no compulsion to go to all the drinking parties, no compulsion to go to all the theaters, even to the games in the Colosseums. But they stood apart from the world. And they lived honestly and soberly. This is the Apology of Aristides, written about 20 years later in 150 AD. They observed scrupulously the commandment of their Messiah. They lived honestly and soberly as the Lord commanded them. So they were living out their faith among the world, but not in the world. I like, Carl Truman writes about this second century church as well. He says, many Christians talk of engaging the culture. In fact, the culture is most dramatically engaged by the church presenting itself with another culture, another form of community, rooted in her worship practices, manifested in the loving community both in and beyond the worship service. Many people talk of the culture war between Christians and secularism, and certainly the Bible itself uses martial language to describe the spiritual conflict in this age. But perhaps cultural protest is a way of better translating the idea into a modern idiom. Given the reality and history of physical warfare in the world, the church protests the wider culture by offering a true vision of what it means to be a human being in the image of God. He's talking about what our call is to present what true life is supposed to be, not to show what life in this culture with a little Christianity sprinkled in is supposed to be. He goes on to talk about the second church, Carl Truman does. He says, the so-called Greek apologists such as Justin Martyr addressed the Roman Empire from a Christian perspective. And what is so interesting when compared to some of the ways many Christians, right and left, do so today is how respectful these ancient apologists were. They did not spend their time denouncing the evils of the emperor or his court. Rather, they argued positively that Christians made the best citizens, the best parents, the best servants, the best neighbors, the best employees, and that they should thus be left alone and allowed to carry on with their day-to-day lives without being harassed by the authorities. That's so interesting to me that was the approach. It wasn't railing against their emperor or railing against their senate or even in that sense, railing against their society, but just simply saying, let us be Christians. Just let us have our peace. Let us live in peace and carry out our lives. And what you will see is that we are, as Truman says here, the best parents, the best servants, the best neighbors, and the best employees. And make that case. Again, this aligns with what you read in the scripture when Paul is giving advice to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Find my way over there. He says, now concerning brotherly love, you have no need that anyone write to you. This is 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 9. For you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. For that indeed is what you're doing to all brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more and to aspire to live quietly, to mind your own affairs, to work with your own hands as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly toward outsiders and be dependent on no one. This was Paul's instruction to another church living in another part of the Roman Empire. I think, if I remember correctly, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, he says something very similar to them. in 2 Thessalonians 3. In verse 7, for you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us, because we were not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with toil and labor, we worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you. It was not because we do not have the right, but to give you in ourselves an examples to imitate. For even when we were with you, we would give this command, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. For we hear some of you walk in idleness, not busy at work, but busy bodies. This is not what I'm thinking of. I think he made another commendation here to work in quietness. I might be thinking of 1 Peter chapter 2. But anyway, I'm not going to be able to track that down. I was thinking of the 1 Thessalonians passage. This is what Truman says Justin Martyr was appealing to the people. This is their way of cultural influence. This is their way of battling the culture. This is their way of cultural protest. It wasn't by literal protest. It wasn't by revolution. It wasn't by even political agitation. It was just simply by asking for the right to be good citizens and to living out that calling as good citizens. Truman goes on to say this, I'm not here calling for a kind of passive quietism whereby Christians abdicate civic responsibilities or make no connections between how to pursue those civic responsibilities and their religious beliefs. I'm suggesting rather that engaging in cultural warfare, using the world's tools, the world's rhetoric, and the world's weapons is not the way for God's people. If the apologists and later Augustine were passive quietists, it's rather hard to explain how Christianity became to be so dominant in the West for so many centuries. The historical evidence suggests rather that their approach proved remarkably effective over time. And so it may be again, perhaps not in my lifetime or even that of my children, but God is sovereign and God plays the long game and God's will shall be done on earth as it is in heaven. So he's saying that this was the approach of the second century Christians. They weren't political agitators. They weren't afraid to articulate the value of their faith, even within civic responsibilities. But they did so. They made this cultural protest, not with the world's tools, not with the world's rhetoric, and not with the world's weapons. Now, the way I connect all these dots, as I look at it, even this week, one of my fears is that we as Christians get drawn into that very tactic. We watch what the world does, we hear all of their rhetoric, and we get drawn into not only using their rhetoric, but we get drawn into alliances with the world that wind up making very strange bedfellows. I was reading this stuff yesterday, doing a little bit of preparation for this morning, and took a break, went out to get a few steps of exercise, pulled up my Twitter, and noticed that trending on Twitter was Christ is King. And I didn't know what any of this was about, so looking into it a little bit deeper, I realized that there's some sort of swirling controversy right now. That phrase, Christ is King, is being labeled as a subversive tactic by Christians to undermine the political establishment of society. And I thought, well, how ironic is that? You know, that this, especially on Easter week of all weeks, when we're celebrating the victory of Christ, that this would be looked at as some sort of subversive tactic. But as I dove into it a little bit more and started to find out the players who are involved, I was not surprised. I was not surprised. This seems to, I didn't spend a ton of time on this, so you guys might correct me, those of you who are more socially adept. But it seems as if this all arose out of some sort of partnership or some sort of syndication of a Christian commentator who was working for a Jewish organization or an organization run by Jewish people and wanting to make claims of the exclusivity of Christ. Now, whether or not she was doing those in good faith or not, I'll leave to the side. But it just highlighted to me that what would you expect in the long run if you are aligning yourselves with an outspoken advocate of Judaism, that at some point your Christianity might come in conflict, especially if you're trying to articulate a worldview from a Christian standpoint? What would you expect but that that might bring you into some sort of clash of worldviews? And it was interesting to me that the one who seemed to be trumpeting this, at least on my little Twitter feed, was one James Lindsay, who some people know is an outspoken atheist, but has become, for whatever reason, one of the political bedfellows of cultural conservatives who are pushing back against progressivism. They are not only quoting James Lindsay, but they're appearing with him in talk shows and at conferences and on stages, thinking that somehow this guy who is denying our Savior is going to be the answer for us in communicating to the world what we're all about. Or that Jews are somehow going to be the answer for us in communicating to the world what we're all about. Perhaps it's a reflection of our own intellectual laziness, that we're not busy enough articulating our views from the framework of Scripture in such a way that they can stand on their own, that we're maybe having to borrow from some of the intellectual work of others. But I fear that the thing that's bringing Christians into alliance with some of these people is the fact that at the end of the day, we're all using the same weapons, the same tools, the same tactics, so that our voice becomes indistinguishable from a sort of political right, a sort of social conservatism that really isn't necessarily grounded in the gospel at all. So it can appear at times to the world around us indistinguishable from a James Lindsay or from, you know, so any other sort of a cultural conservative, and that we're not doing the job of articulating ourselves, our worldview. This is what I think makes the second century church distinct. They were articulating what they were articulating distinct from Judaism and distinct from any other sort of nationalism. In fact, it wasn't nationalistic at all by the outside world. It was anti-nationalistic. It was something that from the outside world was actually subverting the state. And yet, as Truman says, whatever they were doing wound up creating a movement that made Christianity the dominant worldview for centuries to come. And it had nothing to do with Christian nationalism and had nothing to do with politics in general. And they had no other allies but Christ himself. This is, I think, the paradigm that you and I need to be looking to. Now, there's more. I got, I don't know, 7 more pages of quotes from other letters and other writings from the first, from the second century, anywhere from 180 to 200 AD, a number of different Christians who, in one way or another, defended the faith, but they did so with gentleness and with respect to all those that they spoke to. They did so clearly, but they did so unapologetically and with boldness. One writer talking about this, Michael Haken, if some of you guys know him as a church historian, talks about how the Christians defend their faith with gentleness and respect, just as Peter commands us in 1 Peter chapter 8, may be put to shame. And the implication is they're slandering you, not because of your speech, not because of your methodology, but for what? For your good behavior. That's why they're slandering you. Not because you're lacking in gentleness and tact. Sometimes I think we consider those who are most brash, those who are most prone to reviling authorities, those who are most adept at mocking the other side, or even our leaders, to be the ones who are most to be emulated. But that may very well just be adopting the world's methodology. When we're called in Titus 3:2 to show perfect courtesy to all people, or in 1 Peter 2:17 to honor the governor, to honor the emperor. This is the ways that the Bible calls us to live. And this is apparently what the second century church was listening to. They were following the direct instruction that had been given to them by the apostles on how to live their life in that kind of society. And in doing that, they were most effective. They were most effective. All right. I'm not going to go into this other section that I have because I won't get through it in the next